Translation by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. One must conquer the modes of passion and ignorance by developing the mode of goodness. And then one must become detached from the mode of goodness by promoting oneself to the platform of Shuddha Sattva. All this can be automatically done if one engages in the service of the spiritual master with faith and devotion. In this way, one can conquer the influence of the modes of nature. Purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Just by treating the root cause of an ailment, one can conquer all bodily pains and sufferings. Similarly, if one is devoted and faithful to the spiritual master, he can conquer the influence of sattva-gun, rajogun, and tamogun very easily. Yogis and jnanis practice in many ways to conquer the senses, but the bhakta immediately attains the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead through the mercy of the spiritual master. Yasya prasadat bhagavat prasado. If the spiritual master is favorably inclined, one naturally receives the mercy of the Supreme Lord. And by the mercy of the Supreme Lord, one immediately becomes transcendental, conquering all the influences of sattva-gun, rajogun, and tamogun within this material world. This is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita. Sagunan samadittaitan brahma-bhuyaya kalpate. If one is a pure devotee, acting under the directions of the Guru, one easily gets the mercy of the Supreme Lord and thus becomes immediately situated on the transcendental platform. This is explained in the next verse. Srila Prabhupada ki Om Jnana Timiranasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Vena Tasmai Shri Guru Me Namaha. So I'd like to beg the blessings of all the assembled Vaishnavas. We have His Grace Dhananjaya Prabhu. I feel very humbled sitting in before you. Please, I pray for your blessings and all the senior Vaishnavas present also. This is one of those special verses which has a very powerful effect just when considered standalone. Many verses need to be placed into context, otherwise their meaning doesn't fully become apparent. But this verse is one of those just very clear, direct, straightforward verses where a great deal of spiritual instruction comes just from looking at this one verse. Of course, this is the power of Narad Muni's preaching. Here he's preaching to Yudhishthira Maharaj on the occasion of the Rajasuya sacrifice. And of course, a substantial dialogue has already taken place. The whole of the seventh canto is that dialogue. And at this point, he has finally come to this point of emphasizing the spiritual master. We have the scriptures, and they impart a great deal of knowledge, but within the scriptures also, there is this constant emphasis that one should accept a spiritual master. Of course, we know from Bhagavad Gita, the famous verse, Tadvidhi pranipatena, pariprashnena sevaya, upadekshantite jnanam jnanena sattva-darshana. Mercy comes from the spiritual master, and to attract and to absorb that mercy, one needs to question and one needs to serve. So these days in the world, people are very fond of questioning. They ask a whole range of questions. Why is God like this? Why is God blue? How did God create the world? Someone asked me yesterday, I heard somewhere that the entire universe rests on the head of a snake. Of course, in the Bhagavatam, there's a description of Shesha and how the Shishumar planetary system, and so many descriptions are there. How can this be true? Well, they've read some information, they've heard some information, but they haven't done the other part, which is surrender to the spiritual master. Now, sometimes people like to also, you can say perhaps, diminish or deflect the importance of this aspect, serving the spiritual master, very carefully and attentively, in the following way. Sometimes people say that the scriptures are there and a bona fide spiritual master is one who teaches you to follow the scriptures. Therefore, let's see what the scriptures have to say in themselves and let's follow those instructions. And so indirectly we're making use of the spiritual master. Well, of course, this is in some way bypassing the system. Because the reason the spiritual master's input is required is because most individuals, practically you can say, all individuals do not have the power in and of themselves to directly comprehend the scriptures. Prabhupada's purports in the Bhagavatam bring the Bhagavatam to us in a form that is accessible. The Bhagavatam has been existing and has been available for many, many years, many centuries you can say. I think the first written copy or the first recorded copy they're found is from the 16th century. The first printed version. However, you can see that the potency of the Bhagavatam only becomes manifest when a pure devotee gives his Bhaktivedanta purports. Bhaktivedanta, of course, meaning one who has understood the conclusion of bhakti, of Vedanta. Veda Anta, the end of the Vedas, the conclusion, the goal of the Vedas. That is the specific qualification of someone who is worthy to speak on the Vedas. So when that happens, we actually get that empowerment by which we can understand Krishna. The Vedas themselves are very complicated, vast, split into four sections by Vedavyas. Upon seeing that the people of Kali Yuga were not competent to understand them as they were, each section of the Vedas was entrusted to a different personality. And the Vedas cover the body of knowledge by which civilization develops. This chapter is called Instructions for Civilized Human Beings. And when Narad Muni speaks, he's speaking from the position of being a very much a civilized human being who has that competence and potency to teach others how to become civilized. Civilization is defined by people in different ways. Of course, there's the modern civilization, which Gandhiji and Prabhupada didn't think much of in terms of it being civilization. They described it as an animalistic way of life, materialistic, an elaborate system designed to comprehensively send one into hellish conditions of life, repeatedly, birth after birth. Yep, this is civilized, this is civilization in one sense, perhaps in a very external sense, in a way of external refinement, external technology, external sophistication. And yes, those aspects are there undoubtedly. But more importantly than those is the internal civilization, internal advancement that each person needs internally. Because that is ultimately what changes the face of the world. The face of the world, most people try to change by political means, by campaigning in some way, by adopting some system and trying to spread it across the whole world. But actually, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj writes in his magazines that this actually does not need to be done. If one simply transforms himself, transforms herself, their own inner consciousness, then actually that effect will be seen in the world at large. So of course this is the standard phrase we hear, be the change that you wish to see in others, encapsulated for management courses. Being the change is very much what the Bhagavatam is about, very much what Prabhupada's mission is about. Janataga Viplavo, creating a revolution in the impious lives of the world's misdirected civilization. That's quite a lofty goal. But this is actually what real civilization is. Real civilization is when one understands who the source of everything is. That source being Lord Krishna, accompanied by his energies. His energies, as we heard this morning in the small reading, his energies in the spiritual world, they create a wonderful situation for glorious pastimes to take place. Here in the material world, that same energy of Krishna takes on certain aspects of Ranatmika Shakti and Prakshepatmika Shakti. It manifests into those two categories, whereby the living entity is first of all completely covered and secondly dragged down. And this we see happening. From that dragged down condition, it is the mercy of the spiritual master. The spiritual master mercifully seeks to bring one out of that condition through so many ways. When Prabhupada came to the West, on the, we have that famous poem on the Jaladuta. He said, these people in these countries are engaged in the modes of passion and ignorance. How will they understand this message of the Bhagavatam, this pure message of the Bhagavatam, which is meant for those elevated personalities who are completely freed from vice? Pure saintly persons can understand the Bhagavatam. So this chapter is all about, this particular verse is all about elevating one through the modes of nature. Rajas tamas cha sattvena, sattvam chopa shamena cha. From ignorance to passion to goodness, and even that mode of goodness then has to be given up in order to come to that platform of Shuddha Sattva. So there are various techniques by which one can rise through the modes. In the Bhagavatam, there are certain descriptions given. In one description, it is given how one should practice very strictly different aspects of brahmacharya, practicing sense control, practicing different austerities, eventually entering into an area of trance, a type of trance, where in that samadhi, Brahman is reached. And on the platform of Brahman, one is definitely transcendental to the modes of material nature. That is the definition of liberation, that is the definition of transcendence. Now for us as devotees, as practitioners, the very mechanical yogic process is not the process that is recommended or endorsed for us. Rather, the process that is given is bhakti yoga. And that process of bhakti yoga has the ability not only to elevate one through the different modes of nature up to the platform of sattva guna and then beyond to shuddha sattva, but it also has the ability to give pure love of Godhead to everyone. Now this aspect is generally lost to the impersonalists. Kechit kevalaya bhaktya vasudeva parayanaha agam dunvanti kartsnena niharam iva bhaskaraha. Yamaraj instructs this. He explains that only a rare person who has developed unalloyed devotional service to Sri Krishna can uproot the weeds of sinful actions with no possibility that they will return. He does this simply as the sun dissipates the fog by its rays. So it appears to be a very powerful process. But this verse itself, the story doesn't end with that verse. It continues in the following verse. This is in Canto 6, Chapter 14. I'll just read the translation of the next verse, because it is very much related to today's thing. If a sinful person engages in the service of a bona fide devotee of the Lord, and thus learns how to dedicate his life unto the lotus feet of Krishna, he can be completely purified, not by tapa adibi, not by different types of austerity. So of course King Rahugan, when he was being instructed by Jad Bharat, also received some very similar instructions. Some of you may know this verse. Rahuganeta tapasaniyati na chejaya nirvapanat grahadva na chandasaneva chalagni suryair vinamahat pada rajobhishekam. Unless one has the opportunity to smear themselves with the dust of the lotus feet of the great devotees, they may not advance in spiritual life. It is not possible to advance na chandasaneva chalagni suryair. It is not possible to advance by accepting the process of sannyas, by renouncing everything and taking sannyas, nirvapanat. It is not possible by strictly following the duties and regulations of householder life. It is not possible by strictly following brahmacharya or by adopting the vanaprastha lifestyle. Nor is it possible by surrounding oneself by blazing coals in the midday sun in summer, performing austerities by those means, or by immersing oneself in water in winter. It is only possible if one smears themselves with the dust of the lotus feet of the devotees and attracts their mercy. So we know that the great saintly persons, they're actually quite liberal in their distribution of mercy. They distribute that mercy quite freely to the whole world. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has already delivered everyone in the world, at least at that time. Of course, the special capacity of this world, this material world, is as soon as a whole batch of people are delivered, a new batch will come. So there's never any danger that this process will mean population decrease. It won't achieve that. Because for every soul that is liberated and goes out, there are hundreds of others who are just waiting for an opportunity to entangle and enjoy themselves further in this material world. But those who have decided to make an exit of this place, they have the opportunity to take shelter of great devotees. And by taking shelter of the great devotees, gradually one becomes elevated. So now the spiritual master's mercy, if we use this word spiritual master in a general sense, spiritual masters are, there are many spiritual masters. Of course, we have the Mahajans who are entrusted with scriptural knowledge. Dharmam tu sakshat bhagavat pranitam, navai vidura shayana api deva, nasiddha mukhya suramanusha kutonu vityadhara charanadeya. There are many categories of persons described in this verse who do not know the real principles of life. Because such religious principles, dharmam tu sakshat bhagavat pranitam, they are enacted by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And they are entrusted to who? To specifically great empowered Vaishnavas, the 12 Mahajans, as the starting point. And then of course, the tree continues, and there are many, many, many great saintly empowered persons in the sampradayas who are empowered to disseminate this message far and wide. And the message only has potency because it is the real religious principles which are enacted by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So then, such persons, they roam around, they come in different generations, in different places, and their mercy is available. But there is a big difference in the consciousness of persons who are able to access that mercy. When Shukadev Goswami was wandering, it is described that before he started speaking on the Bhagavatam, he was being followed by many village urchins, many common folk who were jeering and laughing at him, thinking, who is this person? He doesn't wear any clothes, he just wanders around. Who is this? But then they followed him for some time, and then he came upon this assembly of sages, and immediately he was welcomed with all respect. And they realized, okay, I think we may have entered into a situation we can't comprehend here. And so it's described they left. So this other aspect is that a great soul is not always easily detected by the mass of people. The mass of people have their very rigid, often external criteria by which they judge greatness. Of course, sometimes the Lord will empower individuals to not only be great internally, but to also exhibit that greatness externally. And that we see in the lives of, specifically in the lives of Raja Rishis. Because a king cannot necessarily expect the loyalty and the following of the citizens simply by his own internal situation. The king needs to, in a very external and very visible and powerful way, command the respect of people. So Krishna empowers such individuals so that they are able to exhibit great internal potency and austerity, and at the same time conduct situations which lead the mass of people to advance. These days, the internal situation is almost completely neglected, and only one's external achievements are looked at. Every so often, the incompatibility between a lack of internal advancement and external success, it comes about. And we see it more and more in today's governments, where every so often some major scandal comes out, how someone's internal character is yet again revealed to have been not up to the mark. In India, it can be bribery. Of course, that happened here as well. The whole government was almost brought to a standstill a year or two ago by extensive corruption, people claiming for multiple houses, people keeping gifts. So many things went on. It happens everywhere. In India, it's particularly prominent, to such an extent that the government is unwilling to pass a law outlawing corruption. This is the seriousness of the situation. That when there is a whole system that is built upon a certain way of thinking, a lack of internal character, whatever external effects are achieved, at some point the two clash. And therefore for devotees also, the internal advancement is very much essential. A devotee, when they come to the movement and as they advance through, they will naturally exhibit an increasing amount of external influence, perhaps power, perhaps they will attract respect. And these things are actually provided. They are provided on the path. It is described, different things come to different devotees. Some receive a great deal of wealth. Some achieve following. Some achieve fame, prestige. Some achieve control. And these are there because they can be used by a competent devotee in service. But they are also there to test the devotee who may not be so competent. These are subtle forms of Maya's tests. That she gives those items that a devotee may have hankered for before becoming a devotee. And then those things, if the devotee is not internally strong enough, they will eventually cause that person to, at least temporarily, take a step backwards. In devotional service, there is never any loss or diminution. That we understand. And in the Bhagavatam, there are many examples of this. The sixth canto in particular is a canto full of mistakes that have been made by devotees. Ajamil is there. Bharat Maharaj is there. These are examples of how seeming mistakes take place or fall downs due to negligence, due to inattentiveness. But then the Lord somehow, as a result of that devotee's prior service and sincerity, the Lord brings them out eventually. But they have to learn some heavy lessons on the way. So this process of disseminating knowledge is designed to teach us what those spiritual principles are. How we can function in this world and develop that internal character. Because ultimately, the external show, the external body, even our mental state, which is often detected by people, that will all go. The purpose of liberation, the purpose of leaving this body, going back to the spiritual world, is a process by which we discard these unwanted external layers. Discard this gross body. Discard in the higher stages this material body, which is the actual cause of our entrapment here. All the thoughts, desires, frustrated desires, aspirations, they reside in the mind. That subtle body then carries the soul to its next destination, where it enacts again the whole sequence. That process continues until such point, as Prabhupada says, the individual has become desireless. Not desireless in a Mayavadi sense, but desireless in the sense that he expects nothing more from this material world. And his only interest is the service of Lord Sri Krishna. So when that happens, the devotee is in his rightful place. He's rightfully situated, and he can exhibit his true internal potency. Of course we hear, I don't know where this is from, but we are brighter, we have the power of 10 million suns, it is said. The soul, this is the power of the soul. Yet we are trapped in these pretty pathetic bodies, which allow us to lift perhaps, if you practice weightlifting, you might be able to lift 100 kilos, perhaps, with your arms. Is that right, Nishinapuru? Approximately, perhaps 100 kilos someone could lift. There are some great strong men. I saw this show many years ago, Strong Men. And there was one chap who could pull a train. Of course, it would require a whole week of preparation, and they'd get the train and they'd remove the handbrake, obviously. And then he would be there with his muscles. He would stand at this certain angle, and it would take a good few minutes. He would pull and pull. And a few minutes later, this train would creep forward 1 millimeter, and a little bit more, and a little bit more, until he finally got it moving. That's the maximum we can do in these bodies. Can't do any more than that. If you're a bird, perhaps you can fly high. At best, as a human being, the Olympics are coming up. This is an opportunity for all human beings to demonstrate the best they can do with their bodies. Lifetime of training to demonstrate how this skeleton, skin, bones and muscle can work in their optimum way. I'm not dismissing the Olympics, but I'm just saying that their effectiveness in terms of spiritual elevation is limited. They allow people to compete on an external level. And of course, that you then see the athletes, the level of mental concentration and discipline that it takes in order to bring out the maximum physically. Very, very disciplined. Athletes are very, they restrain themselves from all kinds of things. They eat very regulated diets. They follow very regulated patterns of waking up and going to sleep. They have strict training programs. They have to accept the authority of the coach. So actually you can see these are all techniques for disciplining the mind. And they are very much techniques which are essential in spiritual life. All of those things are carried out by devotees. Devotees should not eat too much, sleep too little. All these things are there in the Bhagavad Gita. And that regulation is a very important aspect. Instruction is also a very important aspect. So regulation has the purpose of elevating one through the modes. By the process of yoga, which is essentially a process of regulation, one can elevate oneself through the modes and get to that platform of mode of goodness, and then liberation. Now of course, because often in the Bhagavatam we hear that the mode of goodness is the platform we should aspire to. We are trying to become free from the modes of ignorance and passion and get to goodness. So this may come as a little bit of a surprise that we have to then transcend that mode of goodness and then come to something else, Shuddha Sattva. Of course we know that Lord Shiva, his position is Shuddha Sattva. Sattvam Vishuddham Vasudeva Shabditam. Lord Shiva, that is his transcendental description. He's fully situated in Vishuddha Sattva, where the words of Vasudev, the full consciousness of Vasudev, manifests. That is called Vasudev consciousness, Vasudev consciousness. Where we adopt the consciousness by which Lord Krishna takes birth, manifests. Shri Shri Radha Gokulananda Ki Jai. When we are in that situation of having executed pure devotional service, gradually Lord Krishna makes his, you can say, appearance or his effects manifest more and more in the consciousness of a devotee. And a devotee does need to be free from all kinds of sinful activities, sinful propensities, sinful desires, in order to fully and purely engage in that loving relationship with the Lord. So only on that Vishuddha Sattva platform does this happen. That one's preconceptions, one's hang-ups, one's existence in the modes which drag them down and fill their consciousness with material objectives, that those disappear. So we climb through the modes, we come to this mode of goodness, whereby the situation is very much improved. The troublesome effects of the mode of ignorance, which are laziness and sleep, and complete ignorance, or the mode of passion where one is driven by a hefty sense of achievement and results and wealth and all the things that come with it, those things disappear more and more in the mode of goodness. And one becomes, as it describes in the Gita, one becomes somewhat peaceful. One becomes peaceful in the mode of goodness. But that peace is really only material peace. At some point, that peace itself can also be disturbed by a different material situation. And the mode of goodness conditions one, often, to develop pride. Now that pride is like a repulsive force that keeps us away from Krishna. So we can see that is not the end goal. That mode of goodness takes us to a certain stage where we have bypassed or we have overcome the limitations of the previous stages. Then making that jump, into Shuddha Sattva, that requires the great mercy of a devotee. That requires the instructions of a great devotee. That requires for us to roll, to bathe our entire body in the dust of the lotus feet of the devotees. Because access to that platform of devotional service is not cheaply given. In the Nectar of Devotion, Krishna describes that, well, Srila Rupa Goswami describes that devotional service is very rare. It attracts Krishna. Therefore it is not given whimsically. It is not just distributed freely. It is distributed freely. But again there is a trick to access it. So this is really the message that's coming through this verse. That the devotees, they give their mercy. And there are many pure devotees around. But unless one specifically, attentively acts in such a way to attract that mercy, that mercy will not manifest purely. When one embarks on a relationship with a spiritual master, the first thing one is expected to do is to serve in some capacity. It may mean direct service to the spiritual master, or it may mean assisting the servants of the spiritual master. Both are on the same platform. Now, when one serves the spiritual master may not immediately teach that person Vedanta, teach that person essential scriptural principles. That may not immediately happen. Of course, when a child, if you take a traditional brahmachari setup, a young boy at the age of 5 would join the Gurukul. Now, the teacher would not immediately start disseminating advanced scriptural knowledge on liberation and different yogic processes. No, the boy would simply be trained. He would be trained to be a humble, menial servant. That is the definition of a brahmachari. Brahmachari guru kule vasanantam gurorhitam. He resides in the house of the guru, in the gurukul, and engages in very simple menial service. Whatever is requested, that's the essential principle. By that service, then the spiritual master may test him. That spiritual master may give him further instructions. But direct spiritual knowledge may not come for some time. We see this in the life of different acharyas. In Ramanujacharya's case, there was one. Of course, there were many, many stories with Ramanujacharya. But there was one great learned Vedanta scholar who came. And he came to Ramanujacharya and he had heard he was a great person. So he came and he said, "Teach me Vedanta. Teach me devotional service. I want to hear from you." And he said, I cannot teach you right now. And he said, "First of all, you have to do a few things." He entrusted him to the care of one of his disciples. And his disciple sent him out. He sent him for a year in a village to be the menial servant of a household or family. He instructed him to cook for them, to do whatever menial things are required in the house. And then a year later, somehow the glories of this person started to come out. And eventually he came back to Ramanujacharya. And at that point, Ramanujacharya said, "Yes, I can see now that you are ready to hear. You are ready to understand scripture." And then he proceeded to instruct him. There are many, many stories like that with Ramanujacharya, Yamunacharya. And the saintly persons in general will only instruct according to the capability of a disciple. I think last time when we were discussing this verse earlier on, I gave this example of Angira Rishi and Narad Muni when they went to see King Chitraketu. The first visit they made to Chitraketu, they could see he was in an ocean of lamentation because he had no son. And at that time, the only thing that he wanted was a son. So they didn't instruct him in great depth in spiritual life. They simply said, "Okay, you perform this series, these penances, these austerities, and you will have a son who will be the cause of happiness and distress." Of course, the son was born. Then the distress came. The co-wives, they poisoned the son. And then Narad Muni came back. And he said, "At that time I could not instruct you. But now that I've seen you're ready, I'm now able to teach you." And he taught him about detachment, how this body is temporary, how the real goal of life should not be to have a son, to have a kingdom. Rather, it should be to come closer to the lotus feet of Krishna. So that service is essential. It is not sufficient to simply read the books. Prabhupada says at one point that merely book knowledge is not sufficient. Simultaneously, one should serve the spiritual master. The spiritual master may give us book knowledge, he may teach us, he may expect us to read the books, but he may not also. That is the spiritual master's mercy. Often people try to put a very rigid criteria or prescription on who is a spiritual master, what must he do. And of course, all those things are valid. Nectar of instruction, one must be regulated in mind, body, word, speech, tongue, belly, genitals, all those things are there. Those are more for the disciple or those are more for the spiritual master or a community which endorses the spiritual master, not so much for the disciple. The disciple's duty is to humbly serve the spiritual master and not always be judging what platform the spiritual master is on. That itself, that of course that process has to take place in the beginning. But for that process to be effective, the disciple cannot constantly be doing that. Because that is a direct contradiction to humble menial service. Humble menial service means one executes the order of the spiritual master without question, using one's intelligence. And in due course, at a time chosen by the spiritual master, and under circumstances chosen by the spiritual master, not by the disciple, the spiritual master may impart knowledge, higher realization to the disciple. So it is very much a process where humility and service is the prerequisite. And the spiritual master's duties come naturally in due course. So I'll stop there. Ask if there's any questions, comments. Dhananjaya Prabhu.